All right, well, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Tara Koppelman. I'm from the University of Nebraska Public Policy Center. And the title of today's forum is In the Middle Class, But Single and Living Alone, What Are the Economic, Racial, and Political Implications? And I really want to thank everyone for coming to the event today. I know that there are just so many things that are competing for your time and attention, so I really appreciate the fact that some folks have come here to spend their afternoon with us. And I think you're really going to enjoy tonight's forum. Hopefully there will be some really good opportunities for some interaction as well. Now, before I introduce Dr. Marsh, I just want to officially recognize some of our partners for today's event. This is the Thomas E. Sorensen Public Policy Seminar Series, and we receive support from the College of Arts and Sciences here at UNL, so we're very grateful for their ongoing support. So I want to thank the College of Arts and Sciences, and also want to thank Dean David Manderscheid. And secondly, I really need to thank the Department of Sociology here at UNL. They were really enthusiastic and very supportive of bringing Dr. Marsh here to UNL to visit us. So I want to thank Dr. McQuillan, who many of you probably know, Chick Chadle, and Lori Dance, and I think Bridget Gooseby. I don't know if she's here as well, but she also helped spread the word. So I really want to thank all the faculty at the Department of Sociology that really helped to bring some of the crowd in today. So I think this would be a nice sized group for some great interaction here. So again, I really want to encourage that. Now, one real quick housekeeping note. I think when you came in, everyone should have gotten a little evaluation form here. It's very short, one page. Before you leave, if you could just fill this out and either just leave it on your desk or maybe just give it to me, or you can give it to Maggie over by the door here. We'd really appreciate that. So again, I want to thank you for coming, and I'm going to turn it over now to Dr. Marsh. Chris Marsh received her PhD from the University of Southern California in 2005. She was a postdoctoral scholar at the Carolina Population Center at the University of North Carolina before joining the faculty of Maryland in the fall of 2008. She's currently an assistant professor of sociology and affiliate faculty of the Maryland Population Research Center, Department of Women's Studies, and African American Studies Department. As many of you know, Professor Marsh's general area of expertise are in the black middle class, demography, racial residential segregation, and education. And she has combined these interests to develop a research agenda that is divided into two broad areas: avenues into the black middle class and consequences of being in the black middle class. And Dr. Marsh has spoken widely on these matters on media, NPR, CNN, among other entities. So it's my pleasure now to introduce Dr. Chris Marsh. Please welcome her to the University of Nebraska Lincoln.
Exactly where I want to stand, so I have to figure that out. Thank you, Tarek. Thank you so much. It's funny, whenever I hear people introduce me, I'm like, oh gosh, kind of embarrassing. I am so thankful to be here today. I want to thank the sociology department. I want to thank Tarek. I want to thank his center. And I actually want to thank you guys for coming out. It's a nice crowd. I'm really excited to see such a great crowd. This is my first time to Nebraska, and so far I am absolutely enjoying it. I've been telling everybody that I'm from Los Angeles, so I come from a big city, and then I spent some time in North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and that's a small college town. And then I went to Maryland, which is a bigger city, and now I'm back in a small college town, and I am happy about it. So that's why I'll let you know. Okay, so one other thing I have to say. I've been up since 4 o'clock this morning, so I was a little tired. So I had to have a little bit of caffeine. My students typically don't allow me to have caffeine, but they're not here and they don't know. So if you don't tell them, I won't tell them. Like, Dr. Marsh, you talk too fast to begin with, so they don't allow me to have caffeine. And if I do have caffeine, I can only have it on Fridays. And I have it today, which is Monday, so I am being completely and totally deviant. The other thing that, I'm trying to figure out how to use my, did we say?
The click wheel should let you scroll between the pages.
We tried it earlier and it was, you know what, down, there we go, down.
Whoa.
It really was working a second ago.
I can do it manually too, let me see if I can do it manually.
I'm probably going to have to stand. Oh. I also just found out about animation too. is that me or you?
Let's see if you can do it. Can you be able to? Okay, I can go ahead.
All right. So there's a couple caveats that I want to So the title, Tara already said what the title is. So there's a couple caveats that I want to start out with. Because we're kind of doing this in an informal kind of way, if you want to ask questions along the way, feel free to. If we start to get bogged down, I'm like, okay, let's wait till questions at the end. But there's something that kind of is burning that you want to ask, feel free to go ahead and ask. All right. Okay. One of the other caveats. I'm probably going to say black and whites. When I'm talking about black and whites, I'm talking about households. I'm not talking about individuals. That'll make sense a little bit later. But I want to make sure that when I say black and white, you understand I'm speaking about households. The last caveat is that, like I said before, if I'm going a little bit too fast, if I'm talking too fast, what I need for you to do is if you pull your ear, rub your head, clear your throat. If you do either one of those, or all one of the three of those, I will know to slow down. Unless you do that, I'm going to keep moving, and you got to keep up with me. So it's up to you if I'm going too fast, okay? All right, so let's get started. All right, so I probably should have put another caveat up there that I really do like audience participation. It really makes it a really much more engaging kind of conversation. So let's talk about middle class for a second. So when we say middle class, what do we mean when we say middle class? More importantly, are you guys in the middle class? You know. So when we say middle class, what do we mean when we say middle class? What does that mean? You own a house?
Not poor.
You're not poor? Right? What else? What else would we say like middle class? How would you define the middle class?
Shrinking.
Right? Like so the middle class is shrinking.
I would say it's above a certain income level.
It's above a certain income level. So we've used home ownership, we've used poverty status.
Education.
Anything else you might possibly include in middle class? It's so funny because there was a study done a couple of years ago, and they said they asked people like if they thought they were in middle class, and like 80% of people thought that they were in middle class. Whether or not they were in the middle class, it just kind of felt like they were in the middle class. So I think it's just kind of a cool thing to say, like, yeah, I'm middle class. Unfortunately, for the how many people are actual college students in the room? We're sharing through college students. For the most part, I think your class status probably, for most of you, the average college student, your class status is still based on your parents' class status. You guys, by all definition, are probably in abject poverty. If you're a graduate student, you definitely are in abject poverty. There you go. So when you think about middle class, think like you don't often think about college students being in middle class. For the most part, you guys kind of follow your parents' class status. All right, so we're going to talk a little bit about how I define the middle class. One thing that Tarek didn't mention is that I'm a demographer, so I look at the middle class from a quantitative perspective. I can either, so that means I use different kind of variables to measure the middle class as opposed to qualitative perspective where I may possibly interview people and think about different kind of ideals or different things that they may possibly define middle class beyond the quantitative measures. But we'll get into that a little bit too. Next. Okay, so here's a question I have for you guys. Do you know someone who was single and who was living alone? Raise your hand if you know somebody who was single and is living alone, yourself included. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, so tell me, raise your hand if you know somebody that's college educated. Raise your hand if you know somebody that makes good money. You can define what good money means. Raise your hand if you know somebody that's working. Raise your hand if you know somebody that's a homeowner. Okay, so for the most part, you guys raise your hands for most of those things. There's two things that I want to talk about today. We're going to talk about those that are single and living alone, and we're going to talk about the middle class. But when I talk about these terms, I want you guys to know exactly what I'm talking about. So when I talk about single and living alone, SALA, single and living alone, S-A-L-A, SALA, that means single and living alone. For one more time, for the spirit of redundancy, single and living alone means SALA. SALA means single and living alone. Okay, so when I talk about SALA, I'm talking about those who are aged 25 to 54. I'm also talking about those that may or may not live alone. This is important. So when we think about the Great Recession that we're just coming through, right? Sometimes people are pooling their resources and they're living with people. Now, these are not romantic partners. They're just pooling resources. So you could be single and living alone, but yet living with someone, okay? But you guys are living independent lives, but for whatever reason, you just decided to pool your resources. So you would be two households, and you'd be two different families in one household. And we're going to talk about family and how you define a family when we get to the end. And then single. What's really key about my work, I'm talking about those that are single. I'm saying single as in never been married, which is kind of different than maybe widowed, separated, or divorced. I'm talking about those who have not in any way been married. I think this is a very different group than those who are married or have once been married. So I want to make sure you understand when I'm talking about single and living alone, we're talking about those that have never been married. And then childless. So I was telling Noel about this earlier. So when I look at single and living alone, I do break it down by gender. I didn't bring all of that data with me. We're going to look at the group as just an entire group. But when you're talking about childless, it gets a little bit sticky. Now, I'm not measuring fertility. I'm actually talking about the presence of children in a household. So when you think about women, it's probably a little easier to determine whether or not they're childless or not. For men, there maybe is a child that's not present in the household, but it doesn't mean that they're childless. It's probably a minority within the group, but I just want to make sure when I say childless, it's actually child just not present in the house. I'm not measuring fertility, so I want to make sure you understand that distinction. Okay, and so there's four measures that I've used to measure middle class status. I'm going to go into more detail about those now, but just so that you have an idea of what I'm talking about, I use education, I use occupation, I use income, and I use homeownership as my four measures for middle class, and I'll explain that. I'll explain why in a second. Okay, so just to give you a little bit of background, when I was in graduate school, I was really interested in understanding racial residential segregation. It's really interesting to understand where people live and why they live in certain areas, especially if they have the resources to live where they can live. So the assumption is you're black and you're middle class, so you have all this social capital. Now that you have the social capital, you can live where you want to live. But yet we know that segregation is really high among blacks and whites, right? So it's like, okay, where are they living and why are they living? So that's kind of where I started with my dissertation. And as I was reading all the literature on segregation, the black middle class kept coming up over and over and over again. And I was also being trained as a demographer at the University of Southern California. And as I was being trained as a demographer, one of the things I was finding in the literature is that marriage rates were declining for all racial and ethnic groups. People just aren't marrying as much as they used to. So I saw in the literature, there was a subtle, especially in the social science literature, there was a subtle kind of assumption that married couple households were decreasing. So if you saw a decrease in married couple households, you were also seeing a decrease in the black middle class. And I was saying, no, I don't think that's the case. So in some ways, they almost put like a value judgment on marriage, saying that to be middle class, you need to be married with 2.5 kids and a black or white picket fence, right? And I was like, no, I think there might be a demographic shift that's going on in the literature and among the black middle class. So that's kind of where my dissertation kind of took off, and that's kind of where my research has gone from there. So here's the one view. It's like, okay, married couple houses are declining for blacks, and we also see that the black middle class is declining. But I'm suggesting an alternative view. And my alternative view is that the single and living alone households are increasing. Married couple households are decreasing, and therefore the black middle class is increasing. So the black middle class is increasing not by married couples, but by single and living alone households. And I had some published work in a sociology journal a couple of years ago that looks at this whole notion, and the alternative view was in fact the case. There was this compositional shift away from married couples to young black professionals, and we'll talk about, and I'll show you some data. Okay, so two things I was kind of like interested, two problems that I came up with as I was trying to do this research. And I'm only giving you like a snapshot of some of the research. There's a lot of other aspects to it, but I only brought a segment of it with me. Please, if you want to talk about more of it, please send me emails. I have no problem sending you the entire study. So household income. So now I'm trying to compare those that are married couple households versus those that are single and living alone. So we're going to talk about how I try to compensate for the different kind of the dual earner versus the single earner, what I did to kind of compensate for that. But then also the direction of causality became kind of important. And with the direction of causality, there's two kind of approaches. The first approach is this I just learned the animation on the plane. The guy next to me helped me with some of my animation. So I have to thank Craig. So the neoconservative approach suggests that marriage leads to middle class status, right? So once you're married, then you're going to be catapulted into middle class status. But let's look at this for a second. So pause. If you have two poor folks and they get married, does that catapult them into middle class status, or does that exacerbate their poverty? You know, it becomes a really interesting kind of question. The other part, the other approach is to suggest the assortive main approach. Is anybody keeping up with this thing that's going on at Princeton right now? Oh, okay, well, never mind. Oh. Well, if you have some, when you're not doing your schoolwork, there's a lady who wrote this article to the woman at Princeton, like, have
yes. Mm-hmm.
She falls.
Yeah, your husband while you're at.
She falls under this assortive mating approach. In case it's on Twitter or Facebook and everything else. She's saying, you know, you should get married, find your husband when you're at Princeton. That's like your number one goal and objective. So I think she's following the assortive mating approach, which suggests that middle class people are more likely to marry and or cohabitate. So once you acquire middle class status, then you decide to move on to the next stage. And so my research is not really trying to grapple with which approach is correct, but I think it does shed a little bit of light on one of these issues, and we'll talk about that a little later. Okay, so one of the things I found out when I was trying to study the black middle class, I was trying to figure out how you measure middle class, like how do you actually measure it, especially from a quantitative perspective. So what I found is that there's no general consensus among social scientists on how to measure the middle class. There's usually four indicators that have been used, and this is from a quantitative perspective. And so these indicators usually are education. Now, when we talk about education, are you talking about college degree, talking about advanced degree? There's no kind of like general consensus on how you define education. I'll tell you how I define it and why I define it. And then occupation. It's like, okay, are we talking about professional occupation? Are you talking about non-professional occupations? How do you actually define it? Then with income, okay, now what do you use for the cutoff for income? Economists love income quintiles. They'll use different kind of quintiles to get to class status. But you don't really know, like, how do you measure income? What would be the middle class income? And I'll talk about what I measure as a middle class income. You guys can, of course, critique that because I've had problems with that over the years. People have had concern about my income, thought it was kind of low. And then lastly, Wealth started to gain momentum in the late 90s, early 2000s. There was a great book done by Oliver and Shapiro called Black Wealth, White Wealth. And it talks a lot about the disparities in wealth between blacks and whites. So with wealth, because I'm using census data, I decided to go with home ownership. So home ownership is one of the key indicators that I've used for wealth when I'm talking about the middle class. So these are the four variables that I've been using in the past. These are the four variables that I'm actually using. So let's look at each of these variables and just see, based on 2010 census data, black households versus white households who are 25 to 54, how they measure on some of these indicators. So let's look at bachelor's degrees. So for black households, 25 to 54, 27% have bachelor's degree versus 45% of whites. So you can see that there's a huge disparity between blacks and whites. When we look at the mean occupation score, now the occupation score is a score that we use in the census. It's from 0 to 80, I believe. So blacks' mean occupation score was at 25, and almost 10 points higher, whites were at 33. Median per person income, note that, per person income is $25,000. The average median income for blacks is $25,000 in 2010, households 25 to 54. For whites, it's almost double that at $40,000. Hit the next slide for me. Okay, animation. And then lastly, homeownership. Homeownership, you can see that this 43% for blacks has actually declined a little bit. I think what we might be seeing here is this Great Recession, because we know that blacks were affected a lot by the Great Recession. Here's a question. Okay, so we see it's 43%, and I don't have the numbers for 2000, but I know that it has been a decrease. And whites is almost, it's 75%. So, but here's a question that's really kind of key. And we'll talk about this a little bit later once I talk about how I actually define the middle class. Can you lose your class status? If you lose your house, and home ownership was one of the key indicators, and you lose your house, have you lost your quote-unquote class status? So that is going to become an interesting question, and more research than I can do. Can you actually lose your class status? So we see there's a decrease in home ownership, so I would argue that yes, according to my definition, you can in fact lose your class status. Okay, so we have a couple of tasks we want to talk about today. We're going to talk about household changes, just overall household changes, to see if these single and living alone households exist. We want to talk about the overall growth of the middle class. We want to talk about single and living alone and middle class. And then we want to talk about single and living alone, or SALAs, by race and by middle class status. Okay, so let's talk about the data that I'm using. I'm using the 1% sample of the 1980, 90, 2000 IPOMs. And then I'm using 2010 ACS 5-year sample. I present most of my data for 1980 and compare that till 2010, but there's data points in between, but I just wanted, for simplicity purposes, I just did the bookends. There's seven household types that I'm interested in. I'm interested in those that are solas, single and living alone. I'm interested in those that are single living with a child. Those would be single parents. I'm interested in those that are single living with an adult. Those would be cohabitors. Those that are in cohabitating relationships. I'm interested in those that are single living with an adult and a child. Those are people that are in cohabitating relationships that have children. I'm interested in those that are married living with children. I'm interested in those that are married without children. And then I'm interested in those that are ever married. So when I say ever married, I'm talking about those that are single, widowed, divorced, separated, widowed, divorced. So ever married, they were married at one point, but for whatever reason, they're no longer married. And I look at ages 25 to 54, and in a larger study, I actually looked at ages 25 to 44. So the trends are a little different for the 25 to 44, but I wanted to look at the larger groups. I present data today for the 25 to 54. And the reason why I decided to go with this age cutoff is because before 25, you're probably still in college or just fresh out of college and you haven't had a chance to establish yourself. I'm not sure at 25. I'm not sure if at 25 you're even established yet, right? And then I tried to, I wanted to make it through childbearing age, so I stopped at 44, and then, you know, with technology nowadays, we can go and have children up to 54. Now, Halle Berry just got pregnant at, 46? So I decided I'm going to go through childbearing age, so I decided to cut off at 54, but 54 is also pre-retirement, too. So I wanted to know, I was really interested in understanding, and the reason why I did this, too, for the larger study, I did well, we'll talk about that in a second. And then I talk about the middle class and race and ethnic specific measures. So I'll talk about what that means in a second as well. So that's kind of like the data. Okay, so, all right. For the larger study, what I did was I made a black middle class index. So here becomes an interesting kind of question, too. I don't even know why I'm holding this, because it's doing nothing. I just realized that. I'm like, okay, I guess it's kind of like my security blanket, right? So. Okay, so here's an interesting question, something I had to grapple with. Now, I'm really interested in understanding, am I interested in understanding the black middle class relative to itself, or am I interested in understanding the black middle class relative to the larger middle class? And so I really had to step back and say, what is more important to me, or where do I really want to take this research? So I thought, would it be better to compare the black middle class to itself or to the larger community? So the larger study compared the black middle class to itself. So I have a black middle class index. I look at everybody in the black households. I look at their median occupation scores, their median income, and then I say whether or not you're above or below that mean or median. And so I said, okay, that makes sense for blacks. Now I'm looking at, for the larger study that I'm doing now, I'm just presenting data for blacks and whites, but I have data for blacks, whites, Asians, and Latinos. Now we know that those two groups are kind of problematic in and of themselves because there's so much nuance that exists among Latinos and Asians, but I have the data. So what I did was I started out having a black middle class index, but then for each racial and ethnic group, they have their own black middle class, their own middle class index. So it's relative to themselves, not relative to the larger population. Just to make sure that I wasn't biasing my data in any way, I looked at how the numbers kind of relate to the larger population, and they're pretty similar. So I'd rather have them relative to themselves instead of to like a larger group. Okay, all right, so what does all that mean? So here's the index. I think the index is really kind of interesting. So again, like I said before, we're talking about households. So when we talk about educational attainment, I'm talking about anybody in the household that has a bachelor's degree or beyond. So if you're married, the husband can have an AA and the wife can have a PhD, and you'll score 1 on the middle class index, okay? So for wealth is pretty easy. Either you're buying the home or you're not. Either you own the home or you're buying. Most of us are still trying to buy our, we're still trying to buy our homes. We don't just own them outright. So either you're buying your home or you're not. So that's how we have it, the wealth indicator. So then you'd receive another 1 on the index. When we get to the occupation score. So I look at, again, similar to education, I look at everybody in the household and say, okay, the average occupation score for blacks is 25. The median occupation score for blacks is 25. If you're above the 25, which is the median, then you receive a score of 1 on the middle class index. I then say, okay, for whites, the occupation score is 33. If you're above 33, then you receive a, at or above 33? don't quote me on that. I think it's above 33. Mm. Don't quote me. And you got to take a picture of me when I'm back. not quite sure. I think it's at or above. So if you're at or above 33 for white, then you receive a 1 on the occupation, on the black middle, on the middle class index. Like I was saying before, if I would look at all household types, regardless of race, the average I think might be 33. So it's very similar to what to the whites anyway. Okay, and then so now you have 3 points. You've got 1 for education, you have 1 for occupation, you have 1 for wealth. And so then, like I said earlier, remember I was saying that we're looking at dual earners versus single earners? So I thought what might be a good idea to do is look at the per person income as opposed to household income. And the reason why I wanted to do that is because I was comparing dual earners versus single earners. So the way the per person income works is that you have a scale value. So the scale value basically says, okay, how many number of adults do you have in the household? Blah. And then plus the proportion of children to adults. So how much do the children actually make up? How much of a children makes up an adult, right? And then how many children do you have in a household? And that's going to then multiply that by the economies of scale. And that's going to tell you how much money each person in the household actually has to spend and how expensive children are in some kind of way too, right? And then we take the scale value, divided by the total household income. And to just give you an idea of how that works, here's an example. So we have a scale value for a household income of $50,000, right? So for married couples with 2.5 children, the dog and the white picket fence, they receive a 2.5. For a single parent with a child, they receive a 1.7. For a SALA, single and living alone, they would receive a 1.0 scale value. And if you divide that by $50,000, assuming all three households have $50,000, the married couples, each individual has $23,000 to spend. In the single parent household, there's $35,000 to spend. And in the single and living alone household, there's $50,000 each person gets to spend. If you add 22 plus 22, that gives you 44,000 that the married couples have to spend, which is still less than what the single and living alone has to spend, what the solids have to spend. So that's what, because I was saying before that when you're comparing dual earners and single earners, it becomes kind of problematic. I was trying to normalize it and compare apples to apples and oranges to oranges, so I decided to go with the per person income indicator. Oh, okay, so with that being said, there's one thing that another caveat that I have to say, and people just get on me about this all the time. Okay, so if you have a married couple who the husband has an MBA, the wife has a PhD, they own their home or are buying their home, they're a lawyer and a businesswoman, and they're renting a really nice lofty apartment on the south side of Chicago? No. Okay, the west side, the east side? What? The non-south side of Chicago, right? In New York. Would they show up in my data as middle class? Nope. Because they do not own a home. They do not own a home. Now, they may have a ton of wealth. They very well may have. But in some ways, we're restricted by the data that we have. And one of the key indicators about the black middle class is like their wealth. Like they don't really have a lot of, there's some concern about their wealth, or their wealth is fragile. Their position in the middle class status is fragile at best because of their wealth. So I had to have some kind of wealth indicator. So if you do not own a home, unfortunately, you do not show up in my data. But it's both good and bad. There's pros and cons to this approach. Part of the pro is that if I didn't include homeownership, my numbers would probably be larger. It'd be probably a larger group. But I wanted to make sure, and I wanted to strongly establish that this group exists. So I made my standards as strict as possible. So I have really strict standards. If I relaxed the standards, I think that we would have like an inflated group. So I made it real strict, and I made it real strict for a reason. So I'm not putting a value judgment to say you have to own a home to be in the middle class. I'm simply saying wealth is one of the things that has been argued in the literature that is important to maintain your middle class status. That's why I keep wealth in. Okay, all right. So the methods that I've used for the study, I'm going to present descriptive results today. But so I also use cross-sectional data. Census data is not longitudinal, so they don't interview the same people every couple of years. So I can only look at a snapshot. I look at 1980, I take a sample of 1% of the population. 1990, I take 1% sample of the population, and so on and so forth. But then what I decided to do, I decided to get a little creative, and I decided to make a synthetic cohort analysis. And I don't present these results today. But with the synthetic cohort analysis, what I did was I looked at those who were ages 25 to 50, 25 to 35 and let's say 1980. And then I went 10 years later and I looked at those that were 35 to 45 in 1990. Because we're assuming that when the census is taking the census, when they're doing the census, a 1% sample really is representative of the U.S. population. It's synthetic. It's not a true cohort analysis. It's not longitudinal, but it's the best that we have. And so then I aged them 10 years later, and I aged them 10 years later. Part of the reason why I did that in the larger study is because I was trying to argue whether or not this is a group that's just marrying later in life, or is this the group that actually exists and is going to be here, and we can no longer stop, and we can no longer ignore them. We have to really think about them. So I have all that data. If you want to see that data, you are more than welcome to see that data. Most of that data is done for, and it's really interesting, by the way, because there is some, we do see some decrease in single and living alone, but it is a solid group. I think it's about a 2 or 3% decrease, but they definitely are there, so there's not, we can't make the argument that they're just married later in life. And that's mostly done for blacks. I'm now starting to do that for other racial ethnic groups. I don't, of course, have the data. I aspire to have that data for today, but I just don't have that. And then I did like logistic regression, but I actually don't. I didn't bring that with me either. Okay. All right. So first of all, we want to talk about, are there any kind of household changes? If there are any kind of household changes, how does that vary by race? Okay. So I want to make sure you guys understand that we're looking at households. This is not middle class. This is not middle class. This is just all black households ages 25 to 54. And so what you can see here, I was trying to figure out how to make this one pulse and like jump out. I couldn't get that yet, but next time I promise you I'll have that down for you. That would have been really hot if I couldn't have done that. But, okay, so the line here are the single and living alone. So what you can see is that they're definitely increasing from 1980 until 2010. Like I said, there's some data points in between, but you can kind of see the trajectory of where we're going. So here's the notorious single parent, black single parent. I am not going to spend my time there. There's been a lot of work that's been done there. We know they're black parents. Blacks are single parents at a higher rate. We get all that. But what's interesting is that the single and living alone wasn't getting enough attention. I said, oh no, there's a group that I think is worth studying. We can kind of talk about this group. Single and living alone. Again, never been married, don't have any children present in the house. The other thing that's kind of interesting is that we see that the married with children line is declining from 1980 until 2000. So married couples with children, the quintessential kind of like a U.S. American family type, is changing in some kind of ways. And so we have to kind of start changing our way in which we think about family. And then also, which I'm trying to wrap my mind around, the ever married, they're declining as well. It's only a little bit of a decline, but they're declining as well. And every other a household type is increasing, but the single and living alone is where I'm going to hinge most of my attention. So this is black households. So just to compare black households 25 to 54, regardless of middle class status, let's compare those to white households. So similar to black households, white households, we see that single married couples with children are also declining between 1980 until 2010. So that being like the quintessential kind of family type is no more, or household type. Also, which is interesting, we see single and living alone are also increasing for married couples. Some of the other households are increasing as well, but I was particularly interested in understanding this line right here. Tara, can you go back one slide? Okay. What I also think is kind of interesting, look where the single and living alone household is for married, for black households. It's the third household type. For whites, it's the third household as well. It's the fourth household. So single living alone is happening for both households, for both blacks and whites, but it's slightly more pronounced for blacks than it is for whites. Again, we're talking about regardless of class status. We're going to get into class status in a little bit. Okay. All right. So just a general conclusion about household types. We can see that household compositions are changing. Married couples, 2.5 children, a dog, and the white picket fence, that's kind of not so much the American landscape anymore. We also see that changes are happening for both blacks and for whites. If we particularly focus on the single and living alone, we can see that there's an increase in single and living alone for both blacks and whites, but slightly more pronounced for blacks than for whites, and we can also see that across the board that marriage is in a decline. One of the things that I think is kind of important, too, is that I went a couple different ways with this. I wasn't sure if I wanted to include married couples who have children or don't have children. I'm talking about the married couples with children. If I were to put married without children, married with children, I think that the graph will look a little bit different. But I think there is something unique about those that are married but are choosing not to have children. So I didn't want to lump them into that married couple with 2.5 kids. So that's the reason why you see both. Okay, so now we just want to talk about just the middle class in general. Is the middle class shrinking? Is the middle class growing? What is the middle class actually doing? And what are the racial differences? Okay, so remember the four indicators that I talked about earlier? We talked about income, education, occupation, homeownership. If homeownership wasn't in here, what would the numbers look like? But we have the four indicators. So based on these four indicators, we have black households, white households, age 25 to 54. And so what this shows us is that of all middle class households, 13% of black households 25 to 54 are middle class in 2010. In 1980, only 6.5% were middle class. So they've more than doubled in percent from 1980 until 2000. It's interesting to look across, look at the extremes, 1980 until 2000, but it's also interesting to look down. If we compare blacks to whites, you see in 1980, for blacks and whites, 6% of blacks are middle class, and 15% of whites are middle class in 1980. By 2010, 15% of blacks were middle class, and 31% of whites were middle class. And maybe a better way to understand this would be to look at a graph, look at a pie chart. So if you look at a pie chart, you can see that 1980, we can go across and we can go down. So we can see if there's been some growth. The black middle class almost doubled between 1980 and 2010, the white middle class as well. But when we look across, we can see also, like I said before, that the white middle class is twice as large as the black middle class in 1980, and that still seems to be the case by 2010. So I think this becomes an interesting question, because if the black middle class is twice as small as the white middle class, or the white middle class is twice as large as the black middle class, what are some of the sociological implications for that? And we'll talk about that a little bit later. But I think it's kind of good to sometimes kind of step back and just see a graph of it. But what we can say is that the black middle class is growing, we can say the white middle class is growing. There are racial differences. There's still a disparity in the black middle class and the white middle class. So here's where it becomes interesting, because if it's growing, and then we look at the demographic literature, and we know marriage has changed, people aren't married as much as they used to, we can see the numbers here, we can see the graphs that marriage has changed or marriage declining, how is the black middle class growing? How is the white middle class going? And that's where I think that we have to start thinking about how it's growing in different ways and not growing by the regular married couple with children. Okay, so we're going to move on. Looking at single and living alone households. So first, I just want to look at single and living alone households. Then we'll go one step further and look at single and living alone households by class. Okay. All right. So in 2010, close to 31 million households consisted of a one-person household. That's roughly 28% of all U.S. population. There's a really great book that my colleague wrote from UNC. NYU, it's called Going Solo, and it looks at those that are in one-person household. I actually have a copy of it because I was supposed to be writing a book review of it, a very late book review. Oh God, a very late book review. It's an outstanding book though. Here's a really good thing about Eric or Professor Kleinenberg, and where our work kind of differs a little bit. I'm interested in those that are single and living alone, have never been married, and don't have any children. His book, Going Solo, it's a one-person household, but they could have been married, they could be empty nesters, they could be a widow. So his group is very different than my group, but regardless, there are a ton of people that are living alone for very different reasons, but there are a ton of people that are living alone, and we can no longer start to ignore this group, right? We have to kind of take this group into consideration. So one of the things that I wanted to do was I want to talk about the places with the highest percentage of solids in 2010. So let's think about where might single and living alone households live? Where would solids live? This is the test. It's the test. Go back. This is the test. It's the test. Okay. So do we think the brass is going to fall somewhere on there? I was really hoping. I was trying to get you guys' numbers. Not a lot of singles and living alone are in Nebraska. But where do we think most of these single living alone households are?
Urban areas.
Yeah.
Well, let's go, yeah, urban areas. Let's go and look. It's interesting. It's so funny because I live in the DMV. In California, that means the Department of Motor Vehicles. It really does, but on the East Coast, it means D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, right? So the places with the highest number, the highest percent of solids in 2010, some of them, or a good chunk of them, are in the DMV. So we have District of Columbia has 44%. Alexandria, Virginia has 43%, and Arlington, Virginia has 41%. So there's a lot of single and living alone in that area. So if you want to be married, here's a place you might want to stay away from. Or if you're like, if you really want to embrace your single and living alone status, here's a place you should really think about going to live. Denver, I was a little surprised about Denver. I don't know much about Denver, maybe so I can give you some context. But so urban areas, large urban areas, are places where you see a growth of single and living alone households. Okay, all right, so now what I wanted to do is like, I was like, okay, well, let's step back and let's just look at single and living in households for blacks and whites, ages 25 to 54. Again, this is not based on class status. This is just based on the notion about single and living alone. So we see in 1980, so the red line are blacks and the yellow line are whites. So we see in 1980, whites and blacks are pretty similar. You had 8% of blacks that were single and living alone. But by 2010, it jumps up to 18%. Now, some of these might just be in poverty. We don't really know. We just know there's a large chunk of single and living alone households ages 25 to 54. For whites, we see that there's been some growth as well. They've gone from 7% to 12%. So they almost doubled, but the blacks definitely doubled from 1980 until 2010. So again, I think it's been well established now that there is a population that is single and living alone, and we can no longer ignore this group, and they need to be studied much more than they're being studied now. So just to put this in a little bit of context, I thought maybe it'd be great to show what's going on with, you see single and living alone increasing, it'd be great to show how married couples with children, 25 to 54, for whites and blacks have decreased. And now the lines have switched. You now have whites on the top, where in 1980, over half of white households were married. By 2010, you have just under 40%. For blacks, you have 36% in 1980, but by 2010, you have just about 10% that are married. Again, this is not based on any kind of class status. This is just based on just household types. Okay. So what we can say is that the single and living alone households are, in fact, growing. And they are keeping this is not a trend. Trust me when I say this is not a transitional category. It's not that they're marrying later in life. They are actually, it's an established category, and it's not going anywhere. And we need to start thinking more about that. There are some people that will kind of like, in some ways, get married and they will opt out of the category. Like I said earlier, there might be some that drop out. Oh, this, we don't get to the class part. There might be some that drop out of the single and living alone and middle class because they've lost their house. But for the most part, this is the stable group, and we need to start thinking about them in more concentrated ways. Okay. So the last task is we want to talk about solids by race and by class status. Okay. So what I try to do here is I try to give us some columns, and this looks at the composition of all household types in the middle class. So now we are talking about those who are middle class. So all of these households have met four indicators for a middle class status. And what we can see down here, this is visually kind of like interesting, because we can see the single and living alone. We can see that the blacks make up a nice chunk of the distribution for these middle class households, and their distribution is much larger than for whites. The other thing that I think is really kind of like interesting too, when you look at this chart, you look at whites, you look at the green area, those are married couples with children, and you can see they make up a larger share of middle class households for whites, but blacks make up a smaller share, which I think is going to become interesting. We're going to talk about what are the implications of that a little bit later. Likewise, like I said earlier, we talked about, so these are the married, so the green and the brown line are married with or without children. So you can see that marriage is something different in the white middle class than it is for black middle class. You can see that the black middle class are choosing different household types than marrying, the typical married with children to make up their composition, right? And we can see for the most part, whites are going to be probably married with children or married without children. And then like I said before, the ever married is kind of interesting because it's quite large for blacks. I have to go back and look at that because that seems a bit odd to me, but for the most part, we can see that the ever marrieds are also making up a larger chunk of middle class for blacks than for whites. Okay, So I thought it'd be good to kind of step back and say, let's just look at them. These are, again, now we're talking about just those that are middle class who own a home, because you had to own a home to be in this category. 1980, they were similar. Blacks and whites were quite similar. By 1990, we started to see the blacks pull away from whites just a little bit, for those that are single and living alone. By 2000, they're really kind of starting to pull away in great numbers, great percentages. But by 2010, it's like, really? So it's in some ways, the single and living alone have tripled from 1980 to 2010 for blacks. And for whites, there's some steady increases in growth in the single and living alone category, but definitely it's well pronounced among blacks, and it's not as well pronounced among whites. And then just to give you a little context, we're going to look at the other side of that. We're going to talk about married, these are middle class married couples with children. And we can see that blacks and whites are pretty similar in 1980, but when you get to 2010, you can see, and the blacks are steadily declining from one decade to the next. But when you get to 2010, you can see that the blacks are definitely less likely to be married couples with children in the middle class than are white families. Okay. All right, so what can we say? We can say that the black middle class solid households have tripled from 1980 until 2010. We can say for whites, it's not as pronounced. We can say that the white middle class solid households have doubled from 1980 until 2010. Black solids are twice as large as our white solids. I forgot what the numbers actually were, but they're twice as large as single and living alone households for whites. And then we can say across the board that married couples with children in the middle class, that has in fact declined from one decade to the next. And I don't see that that's going to turn around anytime soon. Okay, so let's just go through the summary of our conclusions real quick and then get to our implications. Household compositions are changing. There's changes that are happening for both blacks and whites. Solid households, regardless of middle class status, are increasing. Which would be interesting to look at the other extreme, look at those that are in poverty. Who's most likely to be in poverty, single and living alone households? It'd be great to look at the other side of that. Married couple households are declining, whether or not you're in middle class or not. They're just kind of like changing. And the middle class is continuing to grow, but there is a compositional shift in middle class for both blacks and whites, away from married couples to young black professionals who aren't married, don't have any children. Racial differences do persist among the middle classes. Okay, so here's the interesting part. Black middle class and solid households have tripled, which is just the last slide we just talked about, and white middle class has doubled. So blacks have tripled, whites have doubled. It's growth in both. Both have single and living alone who are middle class, but blacks definitely have more. Okay, so here. Okay, so here what becomes a really interesting question. One of the things that I said at the beginning of the class, I was like, okay, so how do you actually define middle class? Like, if you're a college student, for the most part, you are actually, your parents kind of determine your class status. In some ways, class status is transferred from parent to child, right? So if we look at the middle class and we see that the black middle class relative to the white middle class, we see more married couples with children in the white middle class than we do see in the black middle class. Does that suggest that there's some kind of long-term issues or concerns we need to think about when we're thinking about the white middle class versus the black middle class? Because what happens is that, especially if you have children in the household, you can transfer your wealth from parent to child, right? And so that's now becomes second or third generation middle class. If you have a person in the black middle class who's single and living alone, how are they going to be able to reproduce their class status? So in some ways, you may not see, if you look at this thing 20, 30, 50 years from now, you're going to see an influx of people that are first-time members in the black middle class, first-time members into the black middle class, so you don't have this second, third, fourth generation class status. And that second, third, fourth generation class status gives you some sense of stability, and your fragility is not really a point of contention. But to not have that, it becomes a concern because you're middle class, you're a first generation over a couple of years, every couple of years, that becomes problematic. So I think in some ways you got to think about how this, in some ways, might reinforce racial inequality if you think about how the middle class is structured by household type for blacks versus whites. So like I said before, marriage has some kind of financial benefits and positive returns, but what we see in the black middle class is that we see that there's people that are kind of doing it on their own. They're not getting married, but they're buying homes and they're solid members in the black middle class. So marriage may not be what we actually think it is. I am by no means, I was telling Tarek earlier, I had to do a blog for CNN on some of this stuff, and I got some of the worst hate mail talking about how I'm like anti-marriage, and I am not anti-marriage in any way, not at all. I'm simply saying we just know these people are not marrying. What are some of the consequences of you not marrying, or can we move the discussion in a different way? It's one thing to say, oh my God, there's so many black women that aren't getting married. Okay, we got that. But now that we know that this is the case, demographically we know that there's different trends for blacks and for whites in marriage rates. Now that we know that this is the case, black men aren't marrying, what are some of the consequences? Can we move the discussion one step further? But I think what we can say here is that marriage provides some benefits, but being single and living alone, you're able to do your own thing, you're buying houses, and you're a solid member in the middle class. Like I said, this intergenerational transference of wealth. Here's where I think it's kind of interesting, and where we can talk about the black kind of like kin family network. And so if you're single and living alone and you own a home and you got to put your living will or your trust together, right? It's like, who are you going to give your house to? You don't have a child at this point. Here's where, you have like those social cousins, or you have those godchildren, or you have like a niece that you really don't like, but you're like, that's all I got, so I'm stuck with giving it to my niece. I think blacks in some ways have to kind of get innovative. It's not going to go from parent to child. There's got to be new kind of innovative ways to think about how to transfer their wealth. And also you can give it to breast cancer, Susan G. Komen Society, right? But I think that becomes a really interesting question. We need to start thinking more about that, like how do you transfer your wealth and who can you in fact transfer to, especially when you're single and living alone. So we talked about the direction of causality for marriage versus and class status. Does marriage lead to middle class, or are middle class folks more likely to marry? And so what we're finding is that there's people that are not getting married, but they're definitely in the middle class. So I'm not saying that just proves that, that's the way to go. It's like, well, marriage leads to marriage leads to middle class status. That would, in some ways, you would dispute that because people are definitely not getting married, but they're in the middle class status. I'm not saying we're going to dispute that completely, but it starts to, we cast tangential light. It's for future research. I really would like to delve into that a little deeper, but I'm not sure that quantitative data is going to get me there. Once I have tenure, I think qualitative data would really start to kind of tease out that question. And then, so we talked about marriage as an anti-poverty measure. Like I said before, if you get married and you are two poor folks that are married, that exacerbates your poverty. That does not automatically catapult you into middle class status. So we have to start, marriage is not a panacea. I think it's good in some ways, it's good for society, I'm not opposed to it on any level, but don't think it's going to automatically catapult you into middle class status, okay? And then lastly, which I think is really kind of interesting, so when we talk about family, the way in which the census defined family, there's got to be some kind of relation, you have to have somebody in the house that you're related through, whether through marriage, blood, adoption, or something. Now, my question is, so single and living alone are not considered a family. You will be considered a household, we will be considered a household all day long. We will not be considered a family. The question that I have for the policy people in the room is that, are there some advantages to being defined as a family as opposed to being defined as a household? I can think about, that's a question, hypothetical kind of. I can think about health insurance. I wonder if it's the Marsh family versus Chris Marsh trying to obtain health insurance, am I going to get a better rate if I'm the Marsh family of one versus Chris Marsh? So should we redefine the way in which we think of family? Can a one-person household, not by definition, by census definition, but can a one-person household be considered a family? And that is pretty much all that I have for today, and I will open it up to questions and answers. I was thinking I was going to get questions along the way, but I guess not. Okay. Yes, what's your name again?
Dedrick.
Yeah.
I really would like to see this by gender, because the first thing that comes to mind is the proportion of men and women who are solid, right? And
right.
So the question I have, if I would to see those statistics, is this Wilson's notion of marriageable men or women can be extended, because it's usually for low income,
right?
Can it be extended to middle class now because there's no one around to marry?
Right.
That's not to suggest, though, that people just don't want to be married.
Right.
They don't want
to right.
say that people are trying to get married and everything. So yeah.
Right. Okay, that's a great question. And so there's two ways I'm going to answer that question. One, I think we could probably extend Wilson's kind of marriageability markets. That does really relate to the other spectrum. So but can we think about from the middle class perspective if there are people to marry or not? And whether or not people want to marry or not is a really great question. It's like assuming, the question I think is really important, and I can't get to this from a quantitative perspective, you're in the Saleh household, but are you in the Saleh household by choice or by force? Is it a forced position? Or is it, did you have some kind of like agency and you decided this is the way I want to go? So census data is just not going to let me answer that question. That's where, you know, qualitative work is really going to be able to tease out some of these kind of ideas. The reason why, and I've got all this broken down by gender. The reason why I'm kind of hesitant to present the gender stuff, I have it, I'll send it to you. I don't want this to be about black women, because there are definitely black men in this category. I don't want to lose their voice. They're important, but we just don't talk enough about them. But no matter what, whenever I do this presentation, like, oh, so you know those black women you're talking about? No, I didn't say black women. I have black women in here, but I think that it's really important to understand that there's not just women. Do they dominate the category? Yes. For both whites and blacks, I think that is, in fact, for blacks, I know they dominate the category. I'm not sure for whites, I think they probably do as well. But I just didn't want to make it a woman thing. That's the only reason why I didn't present that data, but I do have, but I do have that, excuse me. Yes?
I was thinking about the implications for understanding health as well. So if we think about marriage conferring health benefits, and being in the middle class as conferring health benefits, it really raises interesting implications about understanding other kinds of disparities, right?
Right.
So, and I like the idea that there's voluntary and involuntary solace.
Right.
And that's similar to voluntary and involuntarily child-free or childless folks.
Right.
But, you know, I wonder if it would be really interesting to see other social connections. Like, so do you make up for, if you don't have, like, with people who age without kids, they tend to be more intentional about friendship networks.
Mm-hmm.
And people who age with kids, because people who age with kids assume their kids are going to take care of them. Not such a great assumption.
Right.
But I wonder if people who are solids are more, you probably can't get that either.
Well, okay, I don't know, I don't know who it was. There's two things I found out about single and living alone. There was a Washington Post article that was done a couple years ago, and they actually interviewed me for the article, but my little snapshot didn't make it into the article, darn it. But they were talking about philanthropy. It's real prevalent among these single and living alone households, not just blacks, but for whites as well. So you could see like a lot of giving that's happening now, even in the face of this recession, but the giving has increased a lot. And the other thing we've noticed is that family pulls on this single and living alone. Now, when we're talking about pulling on, what kind of pulling on are we talking? They're draining from these single and living alone households. So it's financial draining, but it's also like, oh, well, Sheila's not married, doesn't have any children. She can come by and take me here, do this. She can come take care of the elderly, the aging parents. So there's a lot of responsibility that exists among single and living alone households as well. And I don't remember who did the study, but I want to say they were out of University of Pennsylvania, but I'm not quite sure. But it was a Washington Post article, and they noted the scholars there. So I think that becomes kind of like interesting as well, see like what single and living, what implications it has for the larger kind of family. And their
Well, if you think about sort of the heterosexual married with kids, privatizes child raising in some ways. And so I'm struck by there were more white women or white families that were single with child than there were black families, although that seems to be sort of the 1990s iconic image, right?
Mm-hmm.
So but it raises interesting questions about if you have fewer heterosexual married with kid, then kids could be more of a public good instead of just a private good. Could we, you know, rethinking family too, like what are our obligations to raising kids in general, not
right.
just our own private raising of kids. It could raise some interesting policy.
Yeah,
that's great. It's an idealistic way of thinking about it.
Am I right?
Yes.
Of course, as I spend a lot of time in Sweden, I can't help but think about the cross-national comparisons. And like, and I know not if the Swedish welfare state facilitates more single and living alone with children, because mm-hmm. there's strong support for children in Sweden, and that just made me wonder what role that might play, the lack of welfare support in the U.S. So. don't know if you've thought about that.
I haven't thought about that yet. I do want to take, I'm sorry I didn't say this, but this is the U.S. only. It's kind of late to say it.
No,
but it'd be great to look at kind of other countries to see if the single and living alone category is kind of pronounced in other areas, other countries as well. It'd be really great to expand that. I just haven't quite gotten there yet. Yeah, I look forward to doing something like that. Yes?
Okay. I have several questions, but I'm going to do one more.
Okay.
Is there any way you can create this typology of middle class? Because I think you raise a really important point. People have these higher levels of education, income, but they don't own a home. So would that put you in a particular category of middle class? And if not, why not?
Yeah, see, so, yeah. So, like I said before, it was really important for me to include the home ownership in there because of the wealth indicator, right? But my dearest friend and colleague, Quincy Thomas Stewart, we know, what I found is that education was actually the hardest variable to load on the indicator. It really wasn't home ownership, it was education, right? So if I took education out, I think that would really increase my numbers in some kind of way. And so Quincy's like, well, did you do a this, that, and the other? I was like, Quincy, I don't know how to spell that. I don't know how to do that. So I can just look at it numerically and see which one has the least, which category has the least percentage, and it's education by far. It's not homeownership. But I kind of think it's really important to me at this point, because I'm really trying to establish that this group exists and it's here, that I want to make it really strict. I think in some ways, if I did relax something, I may want to relax. I'm not sure if I want to, now, I've got the output, because I've taken one variable at a time, I've taken two variables, I've taken one output, one in, and so I even did, with income, I did the median per person income, I did the 75th percentile, I did the 25th percentile. The stuff that was really driving the black middle class, or the middle class index, was actually education. Yeah. Yes.
So, in terms of the bigger causal story, and it's almost this tautological problem about these causal arrows and the fact that family structure is often what people use to define middle class and so on, it seems when you shift scales and you kind of get more onto the decision processes that people are engaged in and how people are sorting into these different family structures, the etiology by race the same? Are people selecting into and finding themselves becoming solas for the same reasons? Are there different processes unfolding?
See, I don't know if that is in fact the case. Because, you know, census data is only going to give me so much, right? Like I was saying, I really want to take, after on the other side of tenure, it'd be great to say, is this by choice? Is this by force? There was an article done a couple of years ago. I was actually at a Population Association of America conference. Where was I? I don't remember where I was. There was a lady named Kate Bollock. She wrote an article in the Atlantic a couple of years ago. And she was talking about all the single women or something like that. And so she had called me. She's like, okay, I've read some of your work and da-da-da-da. She's like, you know, what I find is that white women are choosing, like, in their 20s and even into their 30s to kind of enjoy themselves. And then, like, late 30s, early 40s, they're deciding to settle down and then having a really great time just doing them. I was like, I don't really think that's the same kind of commentary that black women would give you. I mean, black women would give you a very different commentary. And the commentary might be more like, so you get this whole thing about educational homogamy. Right, so you have all these black women that are going to college and getting bachelor's degrees and PhDs, which the PhD they say is the best birth control pill for black women out there, but I digress. Black women may not necessarily have, if they want to marry a black man, they may not necessarily have a black man to marry that meets them on the educational level. So I think black women and white women would have very different commentary. I think the groups exist, but the commentary would be completely and totally different for the two groups. But I haven't done that qualitative work yet, so I'm not really sure exactly how that looks. There's two other caveats I probably should put out here. When I'm talking about black, I'm talking about just African American. I don't believe that I have Africans in my group, and I also don't have biracial couples. It's just black on black couples. So I probably should have mentioned that earlier as well.
I'm wondering if the PSID or AdHealth would give you at least some teasers on different parts of the life course.
I'm doing this great piece right now that I just submitted, which is very loose. Okay, it's not related to this at all, but I think it's really good. So I'm looking at, like I was telling you before, I'm really interested in segregation patterns, right? So I'm looking at segregation patterns over the life course. Where you live as an adolescent, does that really shape your residential, your adult residential location? So when we think about segregation, there's usually three indicators. It's usually When we think about segregation, it's usually either economics, preferences, or discrimination. That's why we see segregation patterns between blacks and whites, for example. Those are usually the three reasons. It's because of discrimination in the housing market. People prefer to live with their own. And then there's, what was the last one? Preferences.
Discrimination.
Discrimination, preferences, and economics. And people don't have the ability to live certain places. But what I'm arguing is that all that stuff actually starts when you're a child. We can't think about adult decisions at just one point in time. We look over the life course. You develop your preferences when you're a child because you grew up in an all-black neighborhood or an all-white neighborhood. So when you have when you become an adult and start making decisions, you then have to start thinking about that. So that's a paper that I wrote looking at segregation from the life course. Super duper excited about that. Just finished that and submitted that a couple of days ago. Loosely, okay, it doesn't relate to your question at all. I just really wanted to say that. I'm so excited about that paper. I'm going to put a plug in for it. So PSID. No, there we go. I use PSID for that. So now I'm learning in PSID. I'm kind of proficient in PSID. So it would be great to actually look at a longitudinal data. It's challenging. So it would be great to actually look at a longitudinal data set to see what kind of trends do we see.
So did you find it matters where you were when you were a kid?
Yes, it does. What were the numbers? That's it, right? They say once you send a paper off, you're not supposed to think about it too much, right? Oh, gosh. For whites, whites lived in a neighborhood that was 80% white as adolescent, and by adulthood, they lived in an area that was 84% white, if I'm not mistaken. For blacks, they lived in an area that was 30, because I was looking at racial differences. So blacks lived in an area that was 34% white, and by the time they were adults, over their life course, they lived in a neighborhood that was 30% white. So it's much more pronounced for whites than it was for black. It matters where you live as an adolescent. Yes, that's kind of cool. I just submitted it, so we'll see what happens. Oh, you had a question. Yes. What's your name?
Patrick. So last week we got to see that England came out with a new social class stratification system with 7 different layers, and you may not have seen it, and the question is not relevant to that, but it's, do you think that it's time to move away from this middle class, lower class, upper class, and try and find finer gradations that can actually measure some of these differences we're seeing up here, particularly with the salad that you're talking about here?
I think it'd be great to kind of move away from this lower class, middle class, upper class. One of the things that was kind of important to me, and I often tell people this, they get a little upset, but one of the things I didn't want to do is I didn't want to pimp the poor. So I don't want to talk about the lower class blacks. Lower class blacks do this. Lower class blacks do that. Lower class blacks do this. I was like, I'm so tired. I'm not going to make my career on pimping the poor. It served me no good. But I think it's important to study the other side, the other extreme. Let's study the black middle class. Oh, another caveat. So if you score a 4 or higher on the middle class index, you're middle class and beyond. Now, I'm not saying that there's like the 1%er, there's any black 1%ers, but you're middle class or beyond. But with that being the case, I think that it's important to understand and study the black middle class. I get a lot of pushback because they're like, it's such a small group, why are you studying them? I said, well, to understand all of black America, we want to study the extremes. So I don't really like the lower class. There's not a lot of work done on the working class at all. But there's not much done on the black middle class, so it's really important that I look at the other extreme. Whether or not we should have these markers, no, we probably shouldn't. But I do think that we should have work that looks at people that blacks aren't in poor. They don't reinforce some of the stereotypes. That's kind of important to me, so that's why I do some of the work that I do. Thank you, Patrick.
I just had a couple of quick questions. My first question was, and I don't know if this data exists in the census, but did you look at correlations between religious practice or degree of religious practice and Salah?
No, I did not, but I don't know if there's any people that do religion in here, but if I'm not mistaken, divorce is really high among black folks who are religious. Is that not? Yeah. It's really high.
And then also I was wondering, what's been the general reaction to your work? I mean, cautious, alarmed, surprise, resistant?
Well, I get the gamut. I do get, in fact, get the gamut. I get a lot of people say, why are you studying black middle class? Like I said before, they're such a small group. People call me, so what I didn't talk about is that I called this group who are single and living alone, solos who are middle class and black, I called them the Love Jones cohort. Has anybody seen the movie Love Jones? Okay. So they call me Dr. Love Jones. I'm like, well, wait a minute. If you guys haven't seen Love Jones, it's basically about, so when, the way I set up the article is I say, like, if we look at, I think media has a good handle on how the black middle class is moving, but social scientists are kind of slow, right? So in media, you think about, like, the Huxtables, right? That was like a show in the 80s, 70s, 80s, you know, not too long ago. The Cosby Show. The characters were the Huxtable. Quintessential black middle class family, or upper middle class, because he was a lawyer, she was a... Something like that. They're both like highly professional. I had like 5 or 6 or 8 kids. But then you started looking. So we saw shows like the Cosby's. Then you go to like single and living single, where you have like 4 black women, I think, living together, living in close proximity to each other. And if you even think about like movies, you used to have Love Jones, and Love Jones kind of spearheaded this kind of move away from married couples to young black professionals. And then we even have like Sex in the City, or you had Bridget Jones's Diary, or you had Sanaa Lathan was in some movie.
Something New.
Yes. So yeah, media kind of under, somebody's like, we got it, is it media bug? So media kind of got it. And so I call the group the Love Jones cohort. They often call me like Dr. Love Jones. They think I'm like a media critic. I'm like, I don't do any work on media or pop culture. I really do not. I thought it was a great way to say, to kind of wrap it around something so a larger audience could kind of understand. And then people, with the single and living alone category, people, the one kind of pushback, the 2 pushbacks that I get is like, you know, you really should drop out home ownership because they can make it inflate your numbers. I'm like, well, I don't want to do that. At least inflate my numbers. And then 2, some people have argued that I'm making a value judgment saying that marriage is a good thing, and I'm anti-marriage, and I'm not in any ways anti-marriage. Oh, and then I did get some pushback saying like, well, this is the transitional category. People are just marrying later in life. But no, this is actually a group that exists. So those are kind of the major pushbacks I get. But other than that, it's like, I get pretty positive feedback about it. One of the things that, the first article, I looked at just black households, and so one of the reviewers said, you know, you have to put this in a larger context. In other words, you had to compare it to whites, right? So I put a footnote in there about whites. So I was like, well, this is great. So now I can take the footnote out and wrap a paper around the comparisons between black and white. So I'm working on one paper that does a black-white comparison, and then I'm working on one paper that looks at all racial and ethnic groups and see what kind of differences there are.
I find myself wondering, so you're working with 1% of the census, right? Like, would it be possible to, rather than just thinking about constructing these measures based upon racial groups, but actually constructing them locally? So, you know, it's like you're talking about your example of people renting, and they're paying, you know, 10 times what I do in a month, but I get to be a homeowner.
Right.
You know, at the same time, you go back to where I grew up, and the people who had the highest incomes would have been basically poorer than that. So you've got this huge variation in terms of what a dollar means, in terms of what having an extra 2 years of college means, in terms of the distribution of occupations that are even available for people who work in the local economy. And so I'm wondering about, rather than thinking about it strictly in the aggregate being a difference by race, a variation within place. It seems like it could make a really cool heat map.
Yeah, that's really, I mean, there's a lot of different ways I can go, and that's one thing that I can actually think about, like, does region make a difference, or how much does region make a difference? I think that'd be great, I just haven't really...
Or even like county, or, I mean, I wonder how far, how local something like that can get.
Right, and that kind of dovetails right into some of my segregation work. Yes, thank you, great. Yeah, another something I can do. No, I think that's fascinating, though, too. And it gets back to, like, think about the 10 places or the couple places where we see, like, the growth of the single and living alone. Is there something unique about that environment? Do they have more opportunities for professionals than they do in Nebraska? So we didn't see Nebraska or Lincoln down there. Oh, that's great. Yeah, okay. That's about 2.5 years away from now. At the end of my fall semester, I'm going to start that. I'm going to call you up. Thank you.
Any final questions? Dedrick, I know you'd mentioned that you had a couple.
No, I don't want to waste other time for my selfishness.
any other questions? If not, I'd really like to thank Dr. Marsh for coming to UNL. It was an excellent presentation. On behalf of Public Policy Center, Department of Sociology, College of Arts and Sciences, we want to thank you for coming. We're going to make sure that we have Dr. Marsh's presentation up on our webpage. We also have audio recorded the presentation too, in case anyone would like to listen to it again, maybe on half speed.
Just turn it down two notches, and I'll be normal speed.
Thank you so much, Dr. Marsh.
Thank you.
I know you've got some few minutes of free time here too as well. So.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.